From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Today, the Mexican consul in Detroit trying to reassure people alarmed about what's ahead under President-elect Trump.
There's a lot of people that may try to take advantage of them, or there's a lot of false information running around that can make people scared.
Reaction to today's sentencing of former Ingham County prosecutor Stuart Dunnings III.
Sexual predators continue to receive shorter sentences than the gravity of their crimes.
Undertaker and poet Thomas Lynch on the healing power of a good obituary.
I work in what is still considered a small town, and so it falls to me sometimes to write obituaries for people that I've known a long time. And there's a catharsis to that, I must say.
Those stories and much more today on Stateside. Welcome to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Today, a Michigan woman shares her battle with OCD in the hopes of helping others who have the same struggle.
What happened was, since I let the OCD in the door, if you will, it became much less of a friend and more of a monster.
But first, that will be later in the program. But first, as the prosecuting attorney for Ingham County, Stuart Dunnings III was the guy who sent people to jail, sent people to prison. Today, the disgraced former prosecutor stood before a judge in Genesee County Circuit Court after pleading guilty to a felony charge of misconduct in office and a misdemeanor charge of engaging in the services of a prostitute. He had been facing 15 prostitution-related charges, including a 20-year felony spread over three counties. Dunnings was sentenced to 3 years probation, with the first year to be served in county jail. With us now is Aaron Roberts, executive director of EVE, which stands for End Violent Encounters. It's a Lansing nonprofit that provides shelter and supportive services to victims of domestic and sexual violence. Aaron, what was your initial reaction to this news that Stuart Dunnings gets 3 years probation and the first year is served in a county jail?
I think there are two takeaways from the sentencing. And one is that the system has held a perpetrator accountable. It has assigned a sentence and held him accountable for the actions to which the court agreed he had been guilty of. The second takeaway is that sexual predators continue to receive shorter sentences than the gravity of their crimes.
When I think of when you and I talked back in March, when these charges initially were filed, would you have foreseen that he would wind up spending 1 year in a county jail?
That's a difficult question to answer because I wasn't sure. I was so surprised at the situation and the gravity of it that I hadn't considered what the end result sentencing would look like. We know that when we look at the sexual assault registry, the individuals on there and the crimes that are listed are often a result of a plea agreement or a process of them working out that deal. It's much less than the actual crime that was committed or they're accused of.
As we were saying at the top of this interview, there had been more serious charges initially, but they were dropped in a plea deal. Attorney General Bill Schuette's office said they made the deal so victims didn't have to testify. And that most serious charge was pandering, where he was accused of using his position of power to coerce a woman to be paid for sex. What are your thoughts about that charge being dropped?
I think it's very typical in this kind of prosecution in that the more weighty charges, especially when we have somebody with the kind of stature that this case was reflecting, that those are dropped through the plea agreements. Sometimes victims would choose not to want to testify, and some choose to take that moment as an empowerment moment. I wasn't involved in the discussions with Mr. Schuette and the victims, and that I hope that the decision to drop the pandering charge was reflective of those victims' perspective.
What comes ahead now? This seems to conclude a pretty dark chapter in the history of the Lansing area's criminal justice system. But what do you want to do going forward, especially with the prosecutor who replaced Stuart Dunnings III?
This opens the door for new opportunities, especially for local prosecutions, in that we have a new prosecutor coming in. That it's been a long time since we've had a fresh set of eyes in that seat. And the local advocacy organizations are excited to enter into a chance to talk with Carol Seaman about sexual assault prosecution and victim support services here in the Ingham County area.
Overall, Aaron, what message do you believe today's sentencing sends to victims of domestic violence and sexual assault, and really women in general?
Again, going back to the beginning of the interview, what we talked about, the takeaways, is that there is an opportunity for us to hold perpetrators accountable. There is a system, and when it works, we can hold people accountable for the crimes that they have committed. The other piece is that takeaway that sexual predators continue to receive shorter sentences than the gravity of their crimes. We have a current national dialogue going on regarding star power and people in positions of power being able to use their power to influence women in different ways or touch women in different ways. And so it's just an emphasis that we need to continue this dialogue, because there's so much more work to do to make this society aware that the presence of power is the area in which people are the most vulnerable.
Aaron Roberts, Executive Director of End Violent Encounters. Eve, Aaron, it was great to talk with you. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
You are not alone. We are with you. That's the encouraging message of a video that was posted on the Facebook page of the Consulate General of Mexico in Detroit. Juan Manuel Solana Morales is the Mexican consul in Detroit. In this video, he speaks to Mexicans who live here.
Paisanos, son momentos de incertidumbre. Ten calma y no caigas en provocaciones y no te dejes engañar.
Señor Morales, welcome to Stateside. It's good to have you with us.
Thank you very much for the invitation. A pleasure to be with you.
This video is entitled Estamos Contigo, We Are With You. What are you saying to people in this video?
Well, basically, very important. After the election, people are feel a little insecure, a little scared because of the lack of knowing for specific things. So what I'm trying to let them know is that you are not alone, exactly. Wait for any really situations before you start acting. Get the information you need to get to make any kind of decisions. And what is more important is that be confident that we'll be able to provide that information and help in the process of the decision, whatever decision you have to take for your life.
What kind of information should people be seeking now?
Well, basically, I think it's important they understand exactly their legal rights as legal immigrants or not, and the options that they have for them and for their families. And the problem is that any time that there's insecurity and the information is not clear, there's a lot of people that may try to take advantage of them, or there's a lot of false information running around that can make people scared, and precisely that we try to stop. Wait until you get the right information, and then take in consideration that things are real, not invented.
You mentioned for people who are here legally and also for undocumented. So let's first talk about those who are here legally. They've got everything in line. What kinds of options and legal things are there for them? What kind of safety net?
I think basically we have to wait to see if there's any change in the attitude of the legislature, and then we can work on that.
And for those who are undocumented immigrants?
Exactly the same. Mm-hmm. We have nothing yet, so we're waiting right now to see if there's any change from the federal government regarding the status of immigrants. How can those changes could affect the Mexican nationals living here in Michigan?
In your video, you say basically we want to inform you about the possible actions or about your belongings, which from February could affect you. It got me wondering, sir, what has your government been saying to you about preparing for a Donald Trump presidency?
Basically, that we have to wait and see exactly what he's going to be doing. There's a lot of things already in the law. I don't think it's that easy to change the law, and let's see what happens. Something we understand a long time ago is one of the things is what you say during the election, and the second is what's going to happen after the election. So it's important to be sure about that. So we are not going to try to overreact before things happen. We'll see how it's going to be affected, the immigration and commerce and everything else.
And indeed, we have heard voices on the Trump team saying that, you know, he's not going to actually build the wall, or he won't actually do all the things he said he would do once he's in office. He just released his plan for the first 100 days, and there was no mention of the wall in that plan. So what do you think about that as you kind of hear the spin being put on things by his team?
We cannot act right now without the real facts. We have to wait until we have the real facts. When we have the real facts, then we have to start making our own decisions. And as a member of the Mexican government, I believe that the relation with the United States is a very long-time relation, and we have to wait until changes happen in the relation so we can react to that. Starting to doing things before that, or making comments before that, I think is wrong.
Have you heard from state officials, from Lansing, from Detroit city officials, you as the Mexican consul in Detroit?
Yes, we have been working with them, especially regarding specific issues that we have detected going around, some situations that happened in some schools. I don't want to mention by name, but we reach out to officials, and they have given us the guarantees that the laws are going to be applied and that the people are secure.
Since Election Day, have you received complaints, concerns? Have you gotten a sense that there is an increase in bullying or things being said to people?
Basically, even before that.
Even before that?
Yes, that's what we put out these numbers so we can really know about these issues and try to contact local officials, police, school officials, whatever we need to do to see what kind of things they're doing to try to educate and, stop illegal actions.
What is it you're saying to people? How can they reach you? What's the best way if people have questions or just even need some encouragement?
Basically, we established a new phone number, a free number, so they can really reach us out and let us know if they have any incidents or anything happened to them, so we can help them with any kind of legal matters if needed. The number will be 1-877-632-6678.
All right, and we will make sure we put that on our post as well. And we will certainly want to keep in touch with you, sir, especially as we move through the inauguration in the days afterwards, as you say, when things become more clear and we understand what that will mean for the Mexicans who live here in Michigan.
Thank you. I appreciate the invitation.
You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. When you think of going to a physical therapist, you probably think of ailing and aging knees, shoulders, and backs. But there is a growing field in PT, helping women with chronic, intimate problems, pelvic pain, bowel and bladder incontinence, painful intercourse. Here's Bruce Labreck. He's an RN and a women's health physical therapist in Bay City with Renew Physical Therapy.
I have patients now who've been in pain for 30 years, and I look at them, I do the examination, and I think, my God, I wish I'd have seen you 20 years ago, because these are fixable issues. They're just so entrenched, they're going to be difficult to remedy, but they're fixable.
And Bruce is with me now. So how does physical therapy address these problems?
We use a number of different things. I'm a very manual physical therapist, which means very hands-on. So where there's muscle spasm, we use manual hands-on techniques to normalize muscle tone, to take away restrictions and pain. But we can also use techniques such as electrical muscle stimulation, different types of modalities, biofeedback. I tend not to use those as much myself, but different therapists use different types of modalities. I'm very hands-on as far as normalizing tissues that have run amok, too tight or too weak, and retraining them. Patients always have an exercise program. For example, whether it's a pelvic pain issue or an incontinence issue or a lack of control issue, there's typically muscle abnormality. If the muscles are too tight, restricted, in spasm, we have to normalize that, but then we have to train them to work normally, which involves exercise and retraining.
And what kind of success rate do you feel you have?
Oh, gosh. With urinary incontinence patients, well over 90% resolution. And what's interesting is I might see an 80-year-old who is fine in three visits, who feels they're 80% resolved and they know what to do to get the rest of their control, and I'll let them go at that point. But I'll sometimes see someone in their late 20s, early 30s, where I might need to see them a dozen times. But we want to get them to a point where they feel they have functional independence so that they're not going to end up back here for therapy. So functional independence is always the goal. Bowel incontinence, very high level of resolution. Pelvic pain, again, it's extremely rare that we don't resolve these issues. But I do see patients where, despite our best efforts, we can't completely resolve their issues. And there are some difficult issues. One I would think of is called pudendal neuralgia, which involves nerve injury to the pelvic area, where we can oftentimes diminish the discomfort, help manage the pain, but oftentimes, at least 50% of the time, patients are left to manage their remaining pain. It's a very difficult problem to resolve.
And I know you wanted to make sure to get a point across to people listening that a big misconception for women, that painful intercourse is something you just have to live with. That's not true.
Gosh, it really isn't. I've heard women being told that this is normal. I've heard women actually being told that you're supposed to have pain with intercourse, and I find those comments disturbing because they're absolutely untrue. And painful intercourse is poorly understood in general across medicine, but it's virtually always fixable if you know what you're looking for and know how to address it. And a skilled pelvic physical therapist generally does know what to do.
Bruce, what are your thoughts about the way the medical field in general approaches women's health problems?
I think there's a lot of education that needs to occur. I've had discussions with gynecologists who tell me they really don't see women in their practices with urinary incontinence or pelvic pain. So that suggests to me that some physicians perhaps are uncomfortable broaching the topics, so they tend not to discuss them. So I like working collaboratively with physicians and really encourage them. Ask your patients about urinary continence. Ask them about bowel function. Ask them about pain with intimacy. And sometimes just by giving the patient permission to talk about these issues, you may open a floodgate, and that can then start the healing process.
And the flip side of that coin, Bruce, is how does the insurance industry view the kind of physical therapy that you're doing with women?
With any physical therapy, we have to be very cognizant of how we deal with the coding. We always have to attach certain codes to the billing process. And understanding how to do that typically resolves any issue. And we typically do find these things being covered so long as we make sure that working with the physicians, we get the proper diagnoses on paper.
So you're saying if it's done right, it can get covered?
Yes, that is generally the case. But if you don't code it correctly, you're going to have a problem. Hmm. But that's just something we have to learn, whether it's a shoulder or a back or any problem. If we don't get the diagnosis correct for a payable diagnosis, we're going to have a problem. So we just have to take care of that, whatever we're treating.
Bruce, are there many physical therapists in Michigan who do what you do, treating women's health problems?
You know, we're seeing more and more all the time. I know a couple of years ago it was stated that this was the fastest growing area of physical therapy, and we are seeing a greater number. But having said that, we're still relatively sparse. There are only a couple of treaters in the Tri-City area. Our office is actually in the Bridgeport-Frankenmuth area, this particular office. And there are a couple of good treaters in the Saginaw area, the Flint area. Ann Arbor certainly has some wonderful treaters. Royal Oak, the west side of the state, Grand Rapids area has some really skilled treaters.
So how would a woman who's hearing this conversation and thinking, you know what, this could be for me, how would she go about finding someone like you?
If you go onto the American Physical Therapy or the Michigan Physical Therapy Association website, you can find a physical therapy directory, and you can look up pelvic physical therapists, women's health treaters. But speaking with other physical therapists, very often I have other physical therapists in other areas who will give them a lead as to how to find a good treater.
And bottom line, what is your message, Bruce, to women who are living with chronic pelvic pain or incontinence or pain with intimacy?
What I would say is most of these problems are fixable. And one of the things I think that's critical to understand, these are very personal issues, and sometimes these women are in tremendous discomfort. I emphasize to my patients that I don't believe in causing pain, and I emphasize to them they have to feel safe and comfortable with the examinations, and I try to help them understand that they need to feel like they're in charge of their situation as we deal with these difficult personal issues. We reiterate those topics on pretty much every visit, you can see where this could be difficult therapy. I love giving our patients a safe place to go where they can get the help they need. Again, most of these problems are extremely fixable.
Bruce LeBrec is a RN and physical therapist, a women's health physical therapist in Bay City. Bruce, it was great talking with you. Thank you so very much for being with us on Stateside.
Thank you, Cindy.
This is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. And now a story from Failure Lab.
Whoa. Are you sure? Are you really sure? What about the doctors who told you this wasn't even possible? I mean, you told me it was impossible for me to get you pregnant.
David Wenzel is an idea architect and writer for Robin Hood, Inc., a creative consultancy company in Grand Rapids. Wenzel was diagnosed with terminal brain cancer back in 2009. Just as he was about to publish his memoir, he got the surprise of his life.
Just send it. That's what I told Chris, my literary agent. And like any proper agent would, he expressed how the third part of my book was still slightly unclear. There was still a fuzzy ending to my story. I knew that. I knew the third part of my story is fuzzy, but I promised God that I would do this, that I would send out my book proposal when whatever material I had was finished. My agent was kind enough to throw up his hands in the air with me and obey what I felt was my next step. I'd been working on this thank you kung fu book proposal for several months, casting off actual paying work in an attempt to climb this next mountain of my life. This proposal haunted me to such a degree that I couldn't even work if I wanted to. But man, after giving Chris the green light, I felt pure elation. I sat at the kitchen table of my sister's house where I was currently shacking up and told God that the results of my book proposal were now up to him. Even if nothing else came from it, I had done my part. Now, it's time for me to return to real work, bill-paying work, or at least that was the plan for the next 20 minutes. I received a text from my friend Lori. She wanted to go grab dinner. But there was something mysterious about this text, almost as if the true meaning of it were displayed hidden beneath the words of the actual images on my phone. I could tell something wasn't jiving, so I asked her to call me immediately. My phone rang. David, today is a crazy day. It's my nephew Ryan's birthday. My dad just had a small stroke, and I'm having your baby. Silence can't quite fully describe the emptiness and the blackness that followed that statement. Whoa. Are you sure? Are you really sure? What about the doctors who told you this wasn't even possible? I mean, you told me it was impossible for me to get you pregnant.
That statement was followed by a rather repetitive, curse-laden understanding of what I was just told. Somewhere at that moment, I imagined, there was a success lab going on and my sperm were signing autographs. I agreed to meet her for dinner, knowing it was my parental duty to take the next steps alongside of her. We agreed to meet at Terra, a little small restaurant in Easttown. But first, I had to call my agent back. Chris, don't send the proposal yet. Yes, why? What had possibly changed in the last half hour when I was so certain this was my next step? There was no way I could tell him. Sensing my last second redirection and my inflection, he was quite concerned and asked if I was okay. I lied through my teeth. Everything is fine. I just need to figure out the third part of my life. I don't know why, but as I drove to dinner, I thought of Pastor Goldman. He was my childhood preacher at First Baptist Church in Papillion, Nebraska. Being a true Southern Baptist preacher, his voice sounded like a gravelly Harley Davidson motorcycle engine. When the Spirit moved, he simply revved up on that engine. But now, his loud and pointed words were focused on me, and I knew exactly how it would sound. You are a drunken fornicator! Laura and I sat across from each other in immeasurable silence. The pain and agony present was equivalent to a breakup dinner. But this was the opposite. This was a together forever dinner. This was a worlds colliding dinner. This was the understanding that my life would be eternally linked to her life dinner. I had stumbled onto something bigger than cancer, something bigger than divorce. I was 50% responsible for a new human being that would show up sometime in May. That night, I laid in bed crying, knowing that any public goodwill that has been built around me through this cancer and divorce would soon be forgotten. I would never be forgiven for knocking up Lori. I felt myself building an argument with my would-be opposers. Listen, this is my first and only one-night stand. This is not my typical behavior. This is not who I am. This is not what I do. But turns out it was what I did, and it is who I am. At the back of my mind, I knew that single event, that single moment, was the first step towards the third part of my story. And I have no idea how this story is going to end. There are days when I am certain I cannot do this. Aware that the inevitable lack of sleep will lead to increased seizures. I'm so scared to enter a lifelong commitment to another human being, my own flesh and blood, while carrying a signed doctor's note approving my mortality. So I continue leaning forward into this brain cancer I was told would kill me. It hasn't. I struggled through a divorce I thought would break me wide open. It didn't. And now, this surprise pregnancy makes me feel that I should somehow know what to do, that I should have some type of survival plan, that I could turn to break the glass on a white box mounted in the hallway entitled Emergency Drunken Pregnancy Help Kit. But it's not there. I checked. I have no survival plan. I feel like a small boy left alone, so scared of what's going to happen. Life is so messy. I really should have figured it out by now. Sometimes people get sick, and sometimes people fall out of love, and sometimes, in a single late night, whiskey-soaked moment, two friends drunkenly fornicate. This is simply a story of Lori's noticeably growing stomach and my noticeably stiffening jaw. I so badly wish I could push pause and hesitate for eternity. But Lori's belly continues to grow like a strange countdown clock, ending previous stories and, as it appears, beginning new ones. But now, I am forced to take this unavoidable first step towards that unknown, yet to be written, fuzzy third part of my story.
David Wenzel is now married to Lori, and they have three daughters together. As of today, Wenzel is not cancer-free, but an MRI earlier this year saw shrinkage for the very first time. He was originally given 5 to 7 years to live. His book, Thank You, Kung Fu, will be released June 7th, 2017. We'll hear more of these stories on Stateside from our partners at Failure Lab, and you can learn more about Failure Lab by going to failure-lab.com. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Some call it the doubting disease. OCD, obsessive compulsive disorder, is when you get recurring and uncontrollable thoughts, urges, and behaviors. They make you anxious, so you begin performing some action you hope will settle the anxiety, maybe washing your hands or excessive cleaning or tapping. Kirsten Pagash of Howell began experiencing her OCD symptoms when she was only 9 years old. After decades of wrestling with her disorder, she managed to get free of what she calls the OCD prison. Kirsten's written a memoir designed to help people struggling with obsessive-compulsive disorder. It's called Leaving the OCD Circus. Kirsten, welcome.
Thank you so much, Cynthia.
When you think about being nine, when symptoms began, what changed?
Well, what happened was I started to hear kind of an inner monologue or an authoritative voice that would give me certain instructions. And in the very beginning, because my childhood was unstable, having some order or tapping out to a certain number brought almost a sensation of control that I was able to do something and apply my energies that way. And what happened was, since I let the OCD in the door, if you will, it became much less of a friend and more of a monster.
And that monster, I know you called that monster Sergeant.
Yes. And the interesting thing about the book is that at the time that Sergeant or OCD came into my life, I had no name for it. And I only came up with the name Sergeant when I was writing the book because it's so intangible and mercurial. I couldn't just say, and this thing, I needed to name it something. And that's why Sergeant seemed to make a lot of sense to me.
Beginning then as kind of a maybe a softer approach to helping you make order out of what you say is a chaotic childhood. How did it evolve to this harder, harsher master you call Sergeant?
Well, what happened was more and more he would come into my daily life, my daily thoughts, and the challenges that would be set out before me became much more rigorous and much more frequently. For instance, I would say tap to the number 20, and if my index finger didn't feel quite right, then he would very quickly tell me it was imperfect and count over. So I'd do another 20. Maybe when I was done with 20, I'd have to do 100. Maybe after 100, I'd have to do 50. And this might have been while I was sitting there, you know, in third or fourth grade, listening to the teacher and silently having to do these tapping drills to satisfy Sergeant.
And then as you get older, you describe in your book, this really put you in a prison.
Absolutely. And a lot of people ask, why do I call my book Leaving the OCD Circus? And one is I definitely speak in metaphors. So prison is definitely a constraining place where OCD can keep you. And the title of the book is the word circus, and not the fun, cotton candy, good time circus as a kid, but the hellish, nightmarish circus. So whether you're in prison or in a hellish circus, if you can't find your way out and you don't know that there is a way out, then you're absolutely stuck.
What was rock bottom?
Rock bottom for me was I had undiagnosed OCD for 22 years. It was not nearly in the common vernacular like it is now. And I really didn't know what was going on with me, but I knew that I was ill. And I would go to the library and look up bipolar or manic depression and try to get my arms around what I was suffering with. And I had a complete mental breakdown collapse in the middle of a street, of all places, in Walnut Creek, California, when we lived there. And that's when I knew I could not exist with this parallel reality, that I really needed help. And it was much bigger than my husband or myself was able to manage.
And what was the moment of help? Under what guise did that help come?
Well, that is a great question. And I have a passion in my heart for NPR, and I always will, because, like I said, I did not know the letters OCD or what they stood for or anything. I was very much in the dark. And my husband, he's an artist. He was at home in his studio, and he heard a PSA from the International OCD Foundation that said, do you or someone that you know or love suffer from? And they went on to explain OCD. And he sat up and thought, oh my God, this is exactly what we're dealing with. And it was the real eureka moment. And luckily, it came very quickly after my collapse in Walnut Creek.
There is a saying that my husband brought with him from Ireland, that the devil you know is better than the devil you don't know.
Absolutely.
So putting a name on that, how did therapy help you?
Well, I was very lucky that through this PSA that there were numbers that I could call to get specialists in my area. And the wonderful gentleman who I'm still in contact with, Dr. Kalb in Northern California, was willing and able to see me that day. And that was really the first big step on the path of health and well-being.
Which you try to share as you write your memoir, you're also trying to help people who either are struggling with OCD or, like your husband, love someone who is. And I'm wondering what the do's and don'ts are for, especially for the family, for the friends. What would you tell your husband, knowing what you know now, when you think of those early years?
There's so many different ways I could answer that, but the first thing, speaking to the person with OCD, is that it's a real medical condition. So it's not just a preference of how you like to do things, and I think that very frequently gets very confused. It is not your fault, and it is a medical condition, and it truly is your brain misfiring. And so you really do have something that is medical. It's not made up.
How does someone know whether what they're doing is a habit, hair twirling or maybe skin picking or things like that, versus OCD? What's the border?
A lot of people say that they're on the spectrum after they read the book or what have you. They say, you know, I don't think I have OCD, but I have things that are kind of similar. Basically, what it means is you give up your existence to satisfy this authoritative voice in your head, and you do strange and odd things just to keep yourself going. For instance, someone might go back and check their door and say, oh, gee, did I lock the door? I want to be safe, so I'm going to go back and check it. Is that OCD? No, that's not OCD. That's just being, you know, responsible and wanting to, you know, keep track of your things and stay safe. What OCD looks like is that there's a lot of what ifs and doubts. For instance, I would have gone back and checked my door and thought, okay, it's locked, I can go on to school. Then maybe I'd get 30 seconds, you know, down the path, and OCD says, well, what if you didn't lock it? Because if you didn't lock it and you do such stupid, horrible things all the time, you could cause a death or something catastrophic to your family and your cats and those that you love. So you better go back and check it, because you could be the cause of all these catastrophes. It'll be on your head, so do what you want. And then I'd go, okay, I need to go back and check. And then not check once, but check up to 100 times. There were times in high school I would go into class and I would be sitting there and OCD would be saying, what if you left it open? There could be a murderer that comes in and stabs your mom to death and it's going to be on you. So much that I can't function in daily life, and I would have to go back home and recheck the door, and very much getting caught in this loop. It's quite different, and it's really quite a falling off the cliff when you have OCD as opposed to just having things that you would like a certain way.
And it's treatable.
It's treatable, and there are different things that you can learn. And one of the things, Cynthia, in my book is that, yes, it's a memoir. So the first half is kind of my story, letting you know what I was working with. I was very much a checker and a perfectionist. However, OCD rears its ugly head in so many different ways to different people at different times. And in the second part of the book, I really write a self-help book. And there's so many things that people can start doing right away so they can get onto their big happy life much faster than I got onto mine. Some people do very well with medication. Other people prefer not to use medication. There's also cognitive behavior therapy, where you kind of retrain your thinking, so your feeling is going to be different. And there's also just management of health and diet, getting enough sleep, and doing things that don't exacerbate anxiety.
And clearly, support people in your life can get a lot from this as well.
Absolutely.
Lots of information in this memoir and self-help book from Kirsten Pagosh of Howell. It's entitled Leaving the OCD Circus, and you can find more information by going to leavingtheocdcircus.com. Kirsten, thanks so much for sharing your story with us.
Thank you so much, Cynthia.
You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. I have a long-standing habit of reading obituaries in the paper. Maybe it's the history major in me. Reading about what somebody's accomplished, the family, the education, the career, whether he or she served in the military. Thinking about the history that happened in that departed person's lifetime. Just what are we looking for in an obituary? And in this era of the selfie, are people deciding to write their own? With us now is Thomas Lynch, the longtime director of Lynch & Sons Funeral Home in Milford, and an internationally acclaimed poet and essayist. It is such a pleasure to have you with us on Stateside,
Thomas. Nice to be here, Cynthia.
You call obituaries one of the honorable duties of the living to the dead, which I thought was a lovely turn of phrase. How so?
I think of funerals as sort of, good funerals are ones that, by getting the dead where they need to go, the living get where they need to be. And so there's this traffic that in the disposition of our dead, the actual shoulder and shovel work of it. The living get to act out those things that are impossible to put into words. Now, part of that, on the same continuum, is this notion of a life review, a record kept of what it is that just happened. So an obituary, a good obituary, ought to first alert people to the fact that someone who has been is no longer. Someone has ceased to be in the way that is remarkable and shocking and breathtaking. So the first thing is to notice the death. It's a death notice. And the second thing is to review how it was this person came to be the one they are, separate from the rest of us. Because whereas the numbers on mortality are convincing, you know, hovering around 100%.
Yes, they are.
Every one of us is the same but different. You're married to an Irishman, so you know this Irishism that catches on to the fact that we are one of a kind and one of a kind.
But it is interesting, you read obituaries, and I do, and sometimes you see ones that are literally as long as the length of the paper, and others are basically two lines that so-and-so passed away, memorial service to be held at a later date, or no memorial service. And I do find myself wondering what is behind that and maybe the kinds of family dramas. And I'm sure over your years as an undertaker, you have certainly had to referee family tensions in all of this.
Yeah. I think sometimes less is more when it comes to good writing, and good editing oftentimes sharpens our sense of it. So where it's true that word count matters, it's also nice if you can have the kind of life that can be accounted for in such a way that it connects you with the rest of the species. I was reading yesterday in the Guardian William Trevor's obituary, and I've read some of his stories, and I was aware of his presence since the time I started reading short stories. But here, this man lived to be 88 years old. He wrote novels and stories, and some of the movies we've seen are based on narratives of his. And yet, reading this obituary, I was able to see how his life and times sort of seeded his narratives, his fictions. And that, to me, was an add-on. There are so many obituaries that I read, like you, and I think, I've been aware of this person, but I didn't know this person. And an obituary should gather together the highlights, the things that were done that no one else could do. I think another thing about William Trevor's obituary is it's very nice. The subject of the obituary, William Trevor, outlived his obituarist, Peter Porter, another man of letters from the UK who died in 2010. But it gives up the truth about so many obituaries is that they're pre-written.
They're pre-written.
Yeah.
And in this selfie era, are we seeing people, are you encountering people that say, you know what, I want to write my own and leave it for the kids to post once I'm gone?
I remember when I had a chance to read Evan Chambers, a composer associated with the university here, wrote an orchestral suite, and he asked some of his poet friends to write poems that became part of the performance of that. One of the performances took place in Carnegie Hall, and I remember saying to Keith Taylor, a dear friend of mine, and I know well-known to you and to your listeners,
yes,
that this is obituary class. You only have to read a poem in Carnegie Hall once, and it goes into that file we keep quietly to ourselves that says, among other things, he read his poetry in Carnegie Hall.
So at least talk with the family, perhaps. Is it worthwhile having conversations with the family, you know?
Of course it is. It is how we get to know the dead that we don't know. Now, I work in what is still considered a small town, and so it falls to me sometimes to write obituaries for people that I've known a long time. And there's a catharsis to that, I must say, to be able to find the sentence and subtract it from the word hoard that really does catch the person. My father-in-law, may his memory be eternal, who died recently, used to say to me at Thanksgivings and Christmases when he'd be sitting in my Barca lounger, you're going to have to write my life story. And we both knew, with the wink and nod that passes between men of a certain age, that he meant that I'd have to write his obituary if things worked out the way they should and I outlived him. But I remember about him the fact that he always saw in the castaway, in the reject, in the secondhand, in the junk, in the refuse at the curb, something salvageable and worthwhile. And I was able to get that. That became his life story because so much of his life was making good out of the thrown away.
What's the process at a typical funeral home, certainly at yours, at Lynch in Milford? What do you do when a family comes in and they haven't had any idea of that? How do you lead them through the process?
My father used to say to me, Cynthia, and he'd say, be sure and ask a question that can't be answered with yes or no. So ask them, you know, was Tom sick a long time or was this very sudden? And usually the family has already begun their own story of this life and death. It's immediate because oftentimes they've been sitting at bedside in intensive care for the past 10 days, or they've been at the hospice or in the bedroom at home where hospice makes their call, or they've been their own caregivers. But whatever the case, they've had a lot of time to think about how they came to be here next to someone who is slowly sometimes, rapidly other times, ceasing to be, and what the meaning of that is. I really do think that has separated our species from all the other things that live and die, because we're the ones who look into the maw of that ceasing to be and say things like, is that all there is? Can this happen to me? Am I all alone? What comes next? Why is it cold? These are questions that rock bass and rhododendrons never ask, but humans do.
The story of how we came to be really is a daily installment, isn't it?
Sure is.
Well, we are very happy to have had you with us, poet and undertaker Thomas Lynch. Of course, his collection of essays, The Undertaking, Life Stories from the Dismal Trade, won the American Book Award and was a finalist for the National Book Award. And his second essay collection, Bodies in Motion and at Rest, won the Great Lakes Book Award. Anything coming up?
I've been bedeviled by a long fiction, which has taken 7 years. Maybe the death of me, but if I get it done, I'll be glad for it.
Thomas, thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
Today's Stateside was directed by Mercedes Mejia. Our engineer was Mike Blank. Our executive producer is Joe Lindstraw. Contributors are Ellie Billings, Mike Blank, Lindsay Scullin, Ryan Grimes, Josh Hakala, Liz Dickey, and Nick Wallace. Stateside is a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thank you so much for listening.